Now with the following session, please take your seats.
Not exactly. So I'm now doing consulting, and so I'm actually using completely ignore
a coffee earlier.
Ignore that part, but email address to work. So I work for the virtual solar observatory, the solar data analysis center.
Well, thank you very much for returning promptly from the break. We are going to change tack a little bit, and we are going to explore a little bit the perspective of editors and publishers on this very important issue of data citation. You have in your agenda and in the additional material the bios of the people, so we are not going to go into those, but it's a fabulous group. And basically, the idea of this session is that really there is no single way to approach this issue, and different outlets and organizations may have different viewpoints and constraints, and there will be some discussion of the difference in disciplines, and the different disciplines may have different issues regarding data citation issues. The other point is that will be discussed in general by the panel is how widespread the requirement is for data access in the current landscape, and how they are reaching out to and supporting the community of users and producers of data with respect to data sharing. And Howard will be talking about the release of a new global framework for linking research data and literature using a common approach. So let's leave it to the experts to discuss this, and we will do the same as Bonnie did with her panel, which is maybe a question after each of the presentations and then a more generalized conversation. So with that, Brooks.
So thank you. I'm Brooks Hansen. I'm Director of Publications at the American Geophysical Union. Previously, I spent about 25 years at Science Magazine. I'll talk a little bit about science's policies in this evolution of data also. And this will follow actually on a lot of the discussion from this morning. Before I get into some of the weeds, just let me say, I think this is a really special time and special opportunity to solve and address some of the problems that we've all been talking about this morning. And I think that is, and as I'll talk about it in the talk a little bit, that it's a time when, and I'm going to exaggerate a little bit, and I know there's been exceptions, some really pronounced exceptions to this, which I'll talk about, but we're kind of publishers, repositories, and funders, and the research community, we're partly operating independently. And what I think's happened recently that makes this a special opportunity time is there's a really good dialogue and commitment among publishers, funders, and repositories working together. And what that does is it sends a common, or it has a common framework that allows us to kind of practice what we're preaching and help the research community because the message is a common message is coming out from those key stakeholders. So I'll talk a little bit about that, and I know Kirsten will talk a little bit more about it in her talk this afternoon. So that's kind of the main point, is I think there's a key opportunity here to take the really next step, which is to help the research community. In my response to Peter's question, which I thought was very good, is my feeling it's mostly cultural, but it's really being enabled by some new technologies, including identifier technology and other technologies that we've also started implementing across the board. And I think Howard will emphasize that in his last talk, because it really, what he's doing is implemented or is possible by those identifier and other technologies that we're starting to implement across the board, not one publisher, but many publishers. Okay, so Requiring access to data is not new. Obviously, there's some journals that go back to even further than this. AGU actually had a policy that was implemented in 1993 before the web, or right when the web was in one place, I think. It came out with a formal position statement for many of the reasons that Marcia talked about, that earth science data are world heritage. They happen once. You need to preserve them. It's a unique experiment like an earthquake. And that's been updated all the way through. There was a very recent update that people like Kirsten and Ruth and others in this room have worked on. Science, Nature, PNAS, and other journals have required certain data deposition and working with repositories for some time. There's other journals in economics and elsewhere that have actually go back before that. And those journals have been evolving their policy. I've just put science's evolution. There were some key steps in 2000, 2005 after ClimateGate at Huang, and 2011, for example, when science started requiring access to code as well. And governments are catching up. We've talked about OSCP, but the EU and other governments are also having open data, or what's left of the EU, and other governments are having open data requirements as well. So this is, it's not just US, it's worldwide. Publishers are, of course, in a worldwide research enterprise. So what is new is that publishers are getting serious about their policies, and they're really requiring access to data. And more are requiring access to code. I was very pleased to see that Nature, which is one of the leading journals, actually the main leading journal that was not requiring access to code, is now requiring access to code. There's some devils in those details, and I'll talk about kind of the pushback or some of the questions we're getting from the researcher community and how those might be addressed as we go forward. So as I'll show in a minute, publishers are implementing common practices around citing data and recently software, and we're working with the repository community to do that. And I think getting the funder community on the same page with data management plans will bring this all together. Developing other common practices, there's various efforts to extend awareness of these policies to researchers, and I'll talk about that very briefly. And there's also publishers are actually developing new workflows from the old Word/LaTeX to PDF/. Let's destroy all the metadata in the production process to only recreate it at the end. Yes, we do recognize that that's a really stupid workflow. And so there's a whole variety of efforts going on among publishers to actually work with the research community so that all the effort that the authors put in to generating the metadata isn't thrown out at the end of the process and recreated again, of which they find errors and proofs. And it's, you can imagine, it's stupid, it's costly. We recognize that we're working on it. And we're also trying to work with repositories, both it's bidirectional or symbiotic, to learn from them because they're a key part in improving key peer review. So some domain repositories with expertise on data, that in many cases is the best way for us to review the data associated with a paper. So what are the best practices? This is a quick summary of some of them. And I'll amplify a couple points that were made this morning. So there are the joint Declaration of Data Citation Principles, and transparency, and so this, I hope, clarifies a little bit of the question that came up around the previous talk. So AGU and many other publishers have agreed to the or have adopted or signed on to the Joint Declaration of Citation Principles, which encourages citing data in the references. AGU, Nature, and other publishers are strongly encouraging other data citations where important. AGU started a journal, Earth and Space Science, specifically to help accommodate that. Transparency in how researchers can access data, which is the statement in the acknowledgement. It's just a short statement to help readers understand that, yes, all the data are here, here, and here. But that does not replace the joint declaration. ORCIDs and other community identifiers are being adopted. Use trusted domain repositories if they are available, recognizing that there are some good general repositories if they are not. Access to data during peer review is important. Supplements, if done, should follow NISO guidelines. this is an important point that hasn't been mentioned. All references need to be in the main reference list. They cannot be, you know, often we see, particularly for metadata papers, there'd be 1,000 references in the supplement. Those are basically lost. Those are not counted in by Thomson Reuters or other citation schools, processes that scroll through Scopus and other things that scroll through citations. So journal policies need to put all those references, and often those are where the data references are going, is buried in a supplement. They need to be part of the main reference list. And another thing is key references and data should be available at the time of publication. No unpublished or in-press references. We had a great amusement at Science. There's a paper that came out in Nature that listed a Science paper as in press for the key supporting conclusions. We had actually rejected that paper. So publishers and repositories are working together. This has been mentioned. 538 journals have signed TOP. COPDES, Coalition on Publishing Data in the Earth and Space Sciences. I'm going to say very little about that because Kirsten's going to talk about that this afternoon. But that's been endorsed by almost all the major publishers across the earth sciences, except for two. And those are the most connected with industry, and I promised in every talk to shame them until they join. Those are the AAPG, American Association of Petroleum Geologists, and the Society for Economic Geologists. And I'll come to that point, back to that point in a minute. The joint declaration has been endorsed by 109 organizations representing hundreds of publishers and journals, and Marsh has talked about the reproducibility conference. Okay, and the challenge, like I mentioned, is practicing what you preach. So this is Coalition, just an advert for Kirsten's talk this afternoon, which will is a way we're trying within the earth science community to pull together these best practices and work with repositories. So next steps. Software citation standards are out by Force 11, and there was another conference that Marcia didn't talk about that she and Victoria Studden led that's working on software reproducibility standards that aligns with what has just come out in draft form from Force 11. So look for that in a couple months. It should be out. A few major publishers are now requiring ORCIDs. Some of the funders are also requiring ORCIDs. And that's going to enable a lot. So as one identifier, AGU is also working on, as Marcia mentioned, with IGSNs and sample identifiers. There's some standardization emerging around institutional identifiers that will also be very helpful. We have, there's other efforts going on by society. AGU is working on two other efforts to help our community practice best practices around data. One is a data management assessment program for helping repositories adopt best practices. And if you want to learn more about that, Shelley Stahl and Cindy Chandler are both in the room. We can talk to you a little bit about that from different perspectives. And we're also starting a data science is a bad word, but kind of data awareness for researchers program to help practice best practices in their data, management of their data through the life cycle. Kirsten, myself, Mark Parsons, a few others, and there's other parallel efforts are going on. So as I mentioned, the key part is practicing what you preach. The publishers have all signed on, but they're not really doing what they've signed on to yet. So we're trying to work through SSP, CSE, and other organizations and other societies to help educate editors, copy editors, on the best workflows to implement what the publishers have said, oh yes, we're gonna do this, but it's really down at the details that there's actually a lot of confusion. I think in part, as you might have heard from the last talk, is we're not doing a good job of communicating to our researchers. And then finally, just a few of the complaints we hear or the feedback we hear. One is, oh, you really want all of my data? And I think that's, again, where we need to work with the community. There's many, many fields. I'll pick genomics, where many labs are generating terabytes of data per night on raw reads. Those are thrown out the next morning. That's not the data we're talking about. There's the community is developing reference standards so that data can be compressed and reported against a reference standard. And it's really working with that community. And this is where the funders and the publishers, from the data management plans to the research community, to the publishers, need to work together, and also where the repositories have great value in saying, this is the standard for our community, these are the data that are most valued to preserve. Just to skip down, there's a lot of kind of urban legends and a few real cases of stolen data, but widely adopted citation standards and norms across the community are, again, important for addressing that. And I would say the biggest problem that we are having at AGU is proprietary data. We have a lot of and data that are actually restricted by governments from being shared, including the U.S. government. Has some restrictions on sharing of data and code. Try to get a code out of a national lab. Good luck. And some of these go back to handshake agreements that researchers have had with commercial companies, particularly in our field, and it's oil and gas and mining companies for their data. And these handshake agreements sometimes go back 10 years, and the times have changed and the expectations have changed. And it's partly educating the research community that, yes, this handshake agreement that I can secretly look at your data and then write a paper about it no longer applies in today's world, and you've got to have a upfront agreement that says, okay, if we're going to have data access, these are what the expectations are for when I go to publish that. Okay, so thank you.
We have time for one quick question.
I have a question. I'll go with the microphone. That was a really nice overview. Just could you say something briefly about how you see the role of preprints in this whole system that you're talking of?
Just specifically, AGU allows posting of preprints on not-for-profit preprint servers, aka archive.org and AstroPH and all its various permutations. So I would hope that, and I think it's valuable, that the community moves to almost open data at collections. I think there's some great examples of release of data at collection and how that has supported science. Kepler would be a perfect example of how that opened up a whole new unexpected field of science. Many of the NASA planetary missions are releasing data as collected now. And I think that would then support, I think the catch of preprints is there's no data requirement per se, open data requirement associated with preprints. And, you know, if they're going to serve their purpose in the community, which is not just, you know, staking a claim, but actually providing discussion and opportunity and awareness of the science, the data have to be done with that. And moving to a kind of workflow where, and I think this gets back to some part of the data training and working with repositories, is going to be the most efficient way for scientists actually to use their data is to collect it right and to put it in the right place as they collect it. And so I hope that, you know, that's a more futuristic thing, but that kind of culture takes hold. And I think that will then help solve that archive problem.
Thank you very much. And Helena, you are up.
Good morning. I'm Helena Kusain. I work as a senior product manager for research data management solutions at Elsevier. And this morning, I'll tell you a bit about the work of the Publisher Early Adopters Group in the context of the data citation implementation pilot that Force 11 is currently carrying out. Tim Clark this afternoon will tell you a bit more about the Force 11 data citation implementation pilot, but in my talk, I will already focus on the work that the publishers are doing. I think the concept is actually quite simple. I mean, what we want to achieve is that authors start citing data sets in their manuscripts and that then we have a good way of displaying the references in the article and in the reference list of the article. However, there are actually quite a few steps involved in making this happen. And I think after publishers endorse the Joint Declaration of Data Citation Principles and started looking into the implementation, they actually realized it might not be very simple and that there were still some open questions and some changes to the infrastructure that needed to be made. And therefore, progress might not have been as fast as people might have expected. We already heard from the previous speaker that the implementation hasn't been completed by all publishers yet. And I think that is because there are still important open questions. And therefore, now within this group, we got together with a lot of different publishers. So Springer Nature is part of this, PLOS, eLife, Frontiers. I'm sure I'm forgetting a lot of other publishers, but hopefully Tim will have a better overview this afternoon. And so within this group, we're actually talking about all these questions. And what we're trying to do is we're trying to create a roadmap that can be used by all publishers that want to implement data citation. So that's the main goal. And we want the roadmap to be sort of general enough that it is relevant for all publishers, but also specific enough that it really lists all the steps that need to be taken to implement data citation. So yeah, that's our main goal. So what we've decided to do is that we're following the life of a paper, and we've identified four different stages. So there's a pre-submission stage, which is really about providing the relevant information, providing guidance, not just for authors, but also for editors, for reviewers. And the second stage is the submission stage, where it's very important that we capture all the relevant information. And then the production stage is very much about infrastructure. What underlying infrastructure is needed to work with data citation? And then the last part is the publication, where it's about displaying the data. So this is very much work in progress. In a way, this meeting almost came a bit too early, because in a couple of weeks' time, we'll actually have a workshop with this group where we'll really be working on the first version of the roadmap. But we've already had several calls, and it's really being developed at the moment. So I thought it was actually also very useful to be here today, because I can tell you about our current thinking, and maybe you can tell me what's still missing and what should be added to the roadmap. So I would really welcome comments and feedback so that we can take it all into account when we meet in a couple of weeks' time and really make sure that everything is included. So yeah, I'll briefly talk you through these different stages. So in the pre-submission stage, what we're thinking is it's very important to specify a policy for data citation. And what I think is particularly interesting here is actually what should be cited. So should it really be the primary data? Should it be all the relevant data, which is pretty much what we do with articles? Should it be everything that supports the conclusions? I think there are some ideas about that, but I think there are also different ways in which this is communicated right now. So that is something we want to make clearer here, I think. Next thing, it's very important to provide the authors with clear information. So communicate what the policy is, but also how they can adhere to the policy. So if you expect them to deposit their data, tell them where they can do that, because it might not be that obvious for authors what the relevant repositories are, where they can deposit the data. Then also provide clear instructions on how the data should be cited with examples, because there are different reference styles and people might not be familiar with all the elements that need to be included in a data reference. So it's important to clearly communicate that. And then next to authors, as I already mentioned, it's also important to provide editors and reviewers with the relevant information, because editors are often also involved in policy decisions. So they need to know about data citation. They need to know why data citation is important. And then reviewers need to know how they can use these data references to access the data and whether they're expected to do that and take this into account when reviewing the paper. And then the last thing is that people with questions should be able to go somewhere. So it's important to have an email address with questions about where people can go, with questions about data, or to make sure that customer services are aware of this so that we can answer all the questions that authors might have about this. So then the second stage, we've actually found in our group that there are different ways to capture the relevant information. Different publishers are already using different ways, and these all have their own advantages and disadvantages. So we're still figuring out what works best. So one way is to actually capture the information within the submission system. And another advantage here is that authors will always come across this. So you will probably capture the information very often. However, then a question is, how do you actually get the in-text citation into the manuscript if you're asking it at this stage? A very obvious way is, of course, to just ask authors to include the citation and the reference in the manuscript, which seems to work well. But then a question becomes, especially at the production stage, how do you distinguish data references from article references? Because they can look quite similar, and you want to really be able to tag it as a data reference. And the third way, something that publishers have been doing for longer, and I think we already saw in previous talks as well, is that there are actually links to data sets, for example, in text or next to the article. And in this case, this does provide you with a kind of citation within a manuscript, but then you still need to provide the citation in the reference list as well. So different ways of capturing information have their own issues, and we're trying to find good ways to resolve these so that we can capture as many data citations as possible. So now at the production stage, data citations need to be tagged in a particular way. And so you basically need all the relevant elements to be able to tag these data citations. And some of these elements are the same as those for articles. So for example, the title and the authors, that's things that articles have as well. But an element like version, that's quite specific to data sets because articles often do not have that. So we might need to make changes to the structure and include these kinds of elements to be able to capture the data citations in a good and also machine readable way. And this is an example that was shared by eLife. They're really trying to provide an overview of what the XML should look like for data references that can then be used by other publishers as an example, and of course also by the typesetters who actually need to provide this structure. And that's another part of the production process that needs to be updated, that typesetters need to get the right instructions to know how to tag the data citations. So then the last stage is the publication stage. Of course, the data citations should be displayed in the article HTML and also in the PDF. And something that's important that we really also wanted to point out is that within the reference list, all the unique identifiers should be expressed as URLs so that people have direct access. And of course, then when they click on these links, it's important that there are landing pages available for the data sets. Now, something we're also still discussing is actually what these data references should look like in the reference list, because this is an example from Scientific Data where they have a specific section for data citations in the reference list. But some other publishers actually include the references in the normal reference list, just alphabetically, for example. So that's also something we're planning to discuss. Is it an advantage or not to have a separate section? And yeah, what would be our recommendation? And then this is a completely optional point, but one we did want to include is that increasingly publishers are highlighting and visualizing data sets within or next to the article. And that's, of course, a very good way to clearly communicate that data is available for the article. So that's also something we really encourage. So as I already mentioned, in a couple of weeks' time, we'll actually have our workshop where we'll be working on the roadmap. It's on the 22nd of July in London. And if anyone would want to attend the workshop, feel free to let me know. I'm very happy to send you an invite because the more publishers join, the better. And also from other organizations, we're very happy with all the contributions to make the roadmap as comprehensive as possible. So yeah, thanks a lot. And I'm happy to take questions.
I see that there is a question already.
Yeah, so this is a Ruth Dewar question again. And it's not so much of a question, but you know, the basic principle is to cite your sources. And I don't think that should change.
Mm-hmm.
But what it does mean is that if you use data from some place, you should cite that data. But then if you did something to that data, like, you know, made some derived product or something, then that is also needs to be available if you have included it, you know, as part of the findings of your research. But if you don't give credit and a real reference to your original sources, that would be a problem, I think. And so that's, I think, just a general principle you guys need to be aware of. I mean, it's really, you know, the fundamental principle of any kind of citation is cite your sources.
No, I think that's a very good point and very important to make that explicit within a roadmap, that also when you actually work with the data and then make the new version available, that it's still important to also cite the original source and give them that credit.
Hi, this is Paul Euler. If you're talking about the life cycle of a research paper, you have to talk about after publication, not just stop at publication. So there's a whole series of events after publication.
So do you have any particular suggestions for which aspects we should then include if we add that category?
Well, over time, I mean, there's a number of things like corrections, like archiving and failed links and what, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there's all kinds of curation issues. I mean, I haven't really thought about it, but there's a whole bunch of things that you need to consider.
Okay, I'll add this as well.
So I think there's a little contention here, though. We're saying, yes, cite the data, and I think you even mentioned perhaps another category of in the bibliography. Often, though, we see, I should say first that we're even saying now let's cite software, and some people have even suggested another category for that. But at the same time, we're seeing some of the publishers are limiting the number of references that can be placed in a bibliography. We've seen them as small as a dozen or 15 at some of the publishers. And if you're citing the data and let's say the software as well, how are we going to fit all those in? Often, if somebody's representing a specific field, there's an expectation that they're going to cite some of the previous literature in that field as well. And so there's some contention there. Could you speak to that?
Yeah, I think that's a very good point. And I think that's also related to the point I mentioned where we still need to discuss, should it be sort of an additional separate thing or should it be included in the general reference list? And maybe this means that we should be saying, okay, even though there's a limited number of references, you are still allowed to cite your data sets in addition to that. I don't know the answer to that yet, but I think that's a very good point to take that into account when we're discussing this question that authors might be dealing with a limited number of references they can include.
You got lots of questions. So what are data is sort of defined in the eye of the beholder. And as Anne pointed out, her field, literature is data. Mm-hmm. And so this notion of trying to tag data citations versus literature citations, isn't it all just evidence? Why is there a need to make the distinction?
I think it's true, but I mean, I think we heard, I mean, probably the thing we've heard most often today is that it's incredibly important that we start including data in the metrics and that it becomes part of the reward system and the credit system. And in a way, I think to be able to get started with that, it would actually be really good if we're able to say, okay, your data set was cited this many times. And probably over time, we'll be doing that in the exact same way as we do for articles, and therefore it will be incorporated. But I think to get started, we'll probably really specifically have to look at data to make it work for now.
Thank you very much. If we have any more questions, we will have to leave them for the end. Erica will give her presentation now. Thank you very much.
Hello, hello everybody. My name is Erica. I work for the Nature Research Group. I'm maybe less familiar with, can you hear me okay? With the concept of discussing how best to cite data in terms of the technical aspects. I'm going to be presenting you the point of view of an editor. I am an editor. I started my career as an editor for Nature Methods and then transitioned to Nature Communications, in the Nature Group. And, I'm going to tell you today about a few initiatives that we're doing specifically at Springer Nature, at the Nature Research Group, in all the Nature-branded journals. And I'm going to tell you more the experience from, like I said, an editor trying to implement these things, our interactions with the authors, and what kind of perspectives and difficulties we may find. Just to kind of lay the grounds of what our policy is at the Nature Group, we have a general principle that mandates that for all our published papers, all the data, the code, the associated protocols, and the materials themselves have to be made available to anyone that requests it to the corresponding author. So that's been our general policy for some years now. Obviously, that deals with author-to-author communication, which is kind of different to what we're talking about now. But that's the basis of our general policy. We do mandate deposition of certain data, as it been mentioned already today, like protein structures or microarray analysis, for example, for the biological field, which is more familiar to myself. But that is very community specific. So some communities have these repositories, are very familiar with this process, and we've actually stepped in to mandate that, as other publishers have, but other communities are lagging behind all of this. What were the updates that we introduced to this general policy? In 2013, we started the reproducibility checklist, has been talked about this morning as well. Basically, this was a document that we require the authors to submit that is checked by the reviewers and the editors. This is not a published document. What it does is it helps authors point to where certain data that we find critical, like statistical data or methodological data, can be found in the paper. So it's really just a checklist that points us as editors to where this data is present, and it has helped immensely in increasing the transparency of our papers, in that we make sure that that information is there somewhere, and the reviewers can check it, and the editors can check it. We've also been encouraging figure source data deposition as embedded in the paper. In 2014, we started to encourage data archiving via repositories instead of as supplementary material, and to acknowledge and cite this data where possible. For that, people were using, we were encouraging general repositories or a curated list of depositories. So this really took off for us with the launch of SciData, which I will talk about in a few slides, which is our kind of signature journal for publishing data descriptors. And in 2016, and I'll talk a little bit more about this because it pertains to the journal I work for, we started a pilot on a mandatory data availability statement in every paper. So every paper that we publish will contain this new section and will at least describe where the data can be found for this paper. And I'll talk about that right now. And we are encouraging data citations, and both of these are currently pilots. We're testing how this works in some journals. So basically, just summarizing here again, the key turning points, let's say, from the Nature perspective in taking up these initiatives were the accession codes were required for a number of years. Someone said, you know, the 1990s for some of the data, 2002 for the microarray data. And then Nature Research signed the Joint Declaration for Data Citation Principles that has also been mentioned this morning. And in 2014, we launched Scientific Data. And with that, we're presenting a journal that's peer-reviewed, and that basically allows the publication of data descriptors, so metadata that helps researchers navigate data that has to be deposited. And here we are mandating deposition in a repository. And the pilots that I'll mention right now that we're doing as of March of this year. So in the first pilot, data availability statement, or DAS that we call it, essentially has been started by five of our journals, Nature Physics, Nature Cell Biology, Nature Neuroscience, Nature Geoscience, and Nature Communications. Basically, what this is at the time of publication, the editor ensures that there is a paragraph in the paper that describes in detail where the data that went into building this paper can be found. We are providing some guidelines to the authors as to how to write this, and as part of those guidelines, we're encouraging them to, as much as possible, deposit that data and cite it. And we are allowing them or guiding them through this, also given the resources that we have from SciData, which has a list of recommended repositories and a certain guideline for data citation. But that is not a mandatory request right now. What we are mandating is at least a description of of where the data can be found. So I can tell you from my experience, because I handle papers every day, that there's a huge variability in how authors are taking up this new request. And from the biological sciences, for example, where the culture, and coming back to this interesting debate of whether the barriers are cultural or technical, it's very much a cultural thing. We've never asked them to do this, and they're finding that oftentimes their response is simple. It's, well, you know, you asked me for the data, I'll give you the data. So it comes back to that full circle of going, you know, sharing the data via the researchers. But I think, you know, this awareness will increase via things like this mandate, because at least we're making it clear in the paper that they have to say and acknowledge where the data is, and we're kind of guiding them through it as much as possible without any questions. So this, like I said, is a pilot. It's only been happening for a couple of months, but you will be seeing some examples in my slides of what this looks like in the papers. And the motivations for this trial, for this pilot, are kind of summarized here and have been mentioned this morning. They're obvious to this audience, so I won't delve into them, but essentially this is to increase public awareness of the importance of the data and to take a first step into kind of requesting some information about where that data is. This is what it looks like in a paper. Essentially, you know, the DAS, the data availability statement, would be these lines up here. Well, the pointer doesn't work, but there would be a reference. In the case when there is a data that's deposited and cited, there would be a reference, like in the top, and then there would be the actual statement that refers to that reference, or it could be something more general, like, you know, the authors say that all the data that went into this paper is, you know, in the supplementary information, or is in, you know, available upon request, or a certain number of options that we give them. And there's another example below. Like I said, our kind of leading journal in terms of these efforts is Scientific Data, which is a specific journal that that has its mission in providing data descriptors to enable reuse and publishing of metadata. This journal, of course, takes the most astringent, let's say, step in our portfolio, and mandates the deposition of the data in one of the repositories that we suggest. So the editorial group in Scientific Data have curated a list of repositories, and the authors are kind of guided through the process of finding the most suitable repository for their data. This is often, from the editorial perspective again, this is often the major challenge. There's a lot of communities that have never deposited data, and they don't even know if there is a repository that would host their data. There's a lot of concerns, for example, in biology about the size of the data and whether someone are the resources available to put that somewhere. So that's the primary, one of the primary challenges of this journal is to help researchers find this. So once the data is deposited, then, you know, there's obviously a data citation. So the journal has created a specific section, like Helena was mentioning, to list where all the data that has gone into this particular paper can be found. So this is, I would say, different to acknowledging the precedence or the source of the findings. As was mentioned before, it's not a reference. It's really where the data that is going to be analyzed and presented in this paper can be found. So this is what the data citation list looks like. And like I mentioned earlier, there's a lot of work that goes into helping authors find the suitable repositories. Just to finalize the future directions of where we're going with this, We have a dedicated group that deals with this. It doesn't involve me. You'll see the head of our, you know, open data publishing department. But there's a lot of discussions of how we can integrate our bigger portfolio of journals, which includes all the Springer journals as well, into this kind of policy and creating sort of like a tier of mandates or recommendations that each journal could adhere to at their different levels, depending on the communities that they serve. But essentially, you know, the company and the journals are working very hard to think about how to take the next steps from here. And here are the acknowledgments, mostly to Ian, who helped me, who prepared all this and spearheading these efforts at the Springer Nature Group. Thank you.
Is there any question right now? All right, so let's move to the last presentation of this session then. Thank you.
So thank you for giving me the opportunity to talk about Scholix. I'm the executive director of CORUS. That's usually what I talk about, which is a clearinghouse for open research in the United States. But here I'm actually representing STM and their efforts along with the RDA in this initiative called Scholix, which is not a new organization, you'll be happy to know. It's a framework for data linking. So let's just move on. There's a lot to get into. So just a quick plug for CORUS. This is the one slide for CORUS. That's it. So basically, CORUS is a cost-effective public access solution for focusing on five things, and the five things being at the top are access, identification, discovery, compliance, preservation. The important thing to know in today's context is that CORUS is a user of identification. It's really a thing that knits together all of these various different initiatives that are going on for the purpose of discovery, access, identification, all that regarding publicly accessible information. That's it about CORUS. Okay, done. Let's move on to STM. So STM, I don't know how familiar you are with STM, so a quick slide on that is they are an organization. They're an international organization. They have representatives of scholarly communication companies and service companies around the world. They are a mix of not-for-profits, societies, university presses, et cetera. There are approximately 125 of those around the world, and importantly, they represent two-thirds pretty much of all annual article output, and over half of that is active peer-reviewed titles. One of the things that I'm involved in is this STM has what's called a Future Labs Committee. And every year in December, this Future Labs Committee, which are technical people, I was formerly a CTO at Nature Publishing Group, so I got to get involved with this, they get together and they do a kind of a brain trust thinking. And they try to look out, you know, in a few years or even presently, like what are the hot things that are going on in our industry? What are the things that we want to go back to our companies and talk about? And as you can see here, data came out first and foremost as a really important thing amongst this collection of future lab publisher type people. So data is a first class research object, and then you can all see all the little things that tie into data, such as the concerns, the erosion of the ecosystem, linking around, all the stuff that we've been talking about this morning certainly came up in that Future Labs conversation. But the important thing to note is data, which wouldn't have been talked really about in this Future Labs group about 10 years ago, is hot now. So STM is also very proud of the fact that they endorse what they call the FAIR principles, which is findable, accessible, interoperable, and reusable. And that's an important thing. We've heard lots of different initiatives. I kind of view this as even higher than all those stuff, but STM tends to do that. They tend to pick a very, very high, lofty one up there. But importantly, they view that a key to making data citation work is linking data and the literature. And I will say CORUS definitely believes in that as well, which is partly why STM has been working really, really hard within the RDA, specifically the RDA Interest Group on Data Publishing, to make this happen. CHORUS has been involved on the periphery of this, watching it, seeing how this is evolving, and wants to see how this will actually work. So that's been my involvement on this, because again, we're a user. So let's get right into it. So SCHOLEX, it stands for the Scholarly Link Exchange. It is about linking research data with literature and that being the greatest value there, okay? But it really says that all the solutions that are out there today are very, very disconnected, and that's inefficient. And we've been talking about that here today already. And so why do we want to do this? Well, we want to increase visibility and discoverability, right? We want to make sure that it's in the right context, because we want to make sure that it's properly reused. And we also want to support credit attribution mechanisms, because all of those carrot and stick approaches need to happen, as we've been hearing in some of the questions earlier today. So again, SCHOLEX is a framework. It's a set of principles to enable us to build the web of literature and research data links. It actually goes beyond the Force 11 ones. It's not in competition with the Force 11 ones whatsoever. It is really, as you'll see, trying to enable something, to make something happen. I'm going to quote Adrian Burton, who's actually one of the co-chairs of this group. Unfortunately, he couldn't be here. So he has said, we've agreed on this framework so that information about data literature links can be exchanged in a standard way and everyone can build up a comprehensive joined up view. And this will make it more rewarding for researchers to share their data and more straightforward to track the impact of their data in the scholarly literature. But as you can see here, current practices are in flux. You've got publishers talking to data centers and data centers talking to bibliometrics, and round we go. So the idea here is, how do we move from these bilateral arrangements, these one-to-ones, if you will, to a one-for-all service model, where all of this happens in the middle, okay? So what they came on, and what this working group really worked really hard on in the last year, is four different things. So a conceptual model, an information model, and encoding options, and exchange options. I'm going to go quickly through all of this, but all of this information is available on scholex.org. By the way, this is pretty new stuff, because this website didn't even exist until June. So the shared conceptual model. Well, here, basically, the idea is that there are already these center hubs of information. So most of the journals in the world pretty much aggregate their metadata at Crossref. Okay, and we've heard it mentioned quite a bit this morning already, that there's a natural aggregation hub for data centers and its metadata, and that tends to be data site. Okay, and you could argue about whether or not each one of those is perfect, but these are some natural hubs out there. And then we could talk about OpenAIR, and that is a natural aggregation hub for institutional data and the institutional repository stuff. And there's more and more. And of course, there's PMC, and there's the European PubMed Central, and there's things like ADS for astronomy, INSPIRE for higher energy physics. I can go on and on and on. There are many of those. But there are hubs out there. And notice, these are no longer the individual publishers nor the individual data centers, but rather these hubs. And the thing, if you remember anything, is SCHOLEX is about getting these hubs to talk to each other, to exchange the information, okay? And so this is a global information ecosystem emerging as a result of high-level few-to-few interoperabilities. Okay, that's really what SCHOLEX is about, and it's really a framework about informal arrangements to optimize the data, okay, and to optimize this exchange of data. It doesn't claim to be fully specified. It doesn't claim to be an open standard yet, but rather it's an attempt to increase interoperability to sort of go down the road to writing the rules. So here's, I love stick figures. So here is a shared set of concepts, and this is about as basic as you get, right? We're allowing parties to start a dialogue, literally, to start working together in a very shared vision. A shared schema of elements with commonly defined values and pre-negotiated API calls allows this to happen, right? Enough on that. So we go a little bit deeper, and you can see that there are some information requirements, but these are amongst those hubs, okay? And so here you've got where object one might be the agent, or sometimes, as we call it in English, the subject of a relationship statement, right? And then you got other ways of determining the direction of relationships could be explored. So, but basically, you've got different objects connecting to different things. And the point is that once one of these hubs has made an assertion and another hub has made that very same assertion, you can make a connection. Doesn't mean that you totally ignore standards, because that would be stupid. But there are many standards. And so what Scholix is exploring are, what are the applicable standards that are out there? There are many. What are the ones that the hubs are already using? How can we already start making connections today? So again, we're not about, you know, locking everything down. You know, it's not restrictive at this point. And in fact, they're planning on exploring some other technologies that have been developed over the past year that I've also been involved with, which is the RMAP technology, which is this distributed scholarly compound object. So there, the idea is that you actually have an RDF embedded right alongside the information, so you can actually expose that. You could describe, where did this data set come from? How was it used? And that gets captured right alongside the data. But that's early days, but there's lots more discussions going on. Again, Scholix really started in June. So when we talk about exchange options, here, again, it's not being very specific, but already we're seeing that the hubs have naturally gravitated towards JSON, right? And some very well-documented APIs that has allowed things to happen. Okay, there's lots more that can happen in the future. You know, you could start talking about OAI PMH, with its digital repositories really love, but honestly, the rest of the publishers don't use that much, but let's face it, this is about hub to hub. You could talk about machine readable information, and you could also talk about things that are more webby, like link backs and web mentions. That could all happen in the future. The thing to note now, though, is that there's already a prototype using this framework. And that's the important thing. Otherwise, I wouldn't have been interested. Okay, and they're already getting information coming from all of these different places. And you can see here some of the people who are actually in the room, Springer Nature and Elsevier, DataCite and Crossref, have all been contributing metadata into this concept. So here it is, right? This is an open, you can see it today, from the Scholix.org site. This is what's called the Data Literature Interlinking Service. Yes, it's rolled right off your tongue, right? Or otherwise known as DLI. And it's really just a first step. It's an exemplar of what could be done. Okay? But the important thing to note is, already in the very, very short time that this DLI has been up and built by the OpenAIR and Pangea people, it contains over 7 million links, which have been coming from all of those different places that I showed you. Okay, and just because they're using this hub-to-hub framework. So what are the next steps? Just to finish this out, it's all about promoting this idea. And part of the reason that I'm even speaking to you today about this is because I knew what Bonnie and everyone were going to talk about. And once I saw that agenda, I said, you got to hear about the Scholix thing, right? I don't run the Scholix thing, but you have to understand it. It's got to get into the mix of the discussion, because there's so many important people that are having this conversation. And it's not just about publishers. It's about data centers, publishers, funders, researchers, kind of what's in this room today. So how do you find out more? Well, you can go to scholix.org. You can see my name listed there. You're welcome to contact me. But I'm actually not the person that has the best information. Talk to one of the two co-chairs, either Adrian or Hilke, right? Or if you feel like reaching out to Afka, she's always fun to talk to. Any questions? Everybody wants lunch.
Thank you. Thank you, Howard. Are there any very general questions, or somewhat general questions, in like 2 minutes, because the next session, we are already late for the next session. Anything? Yeah. Bob?
Yeah, I'm Bob Hanisch from NIST. A general question for the publishers is, do you see any role In the actual data preservation, the data repository functions for the data that is associated with journal articles? And if not, if you're relying totally on external repositories, what process do you use to vet those? How do you decide which ones are acceptable and which ones are not acceptable?
So this is Brooks again. So publishers have obviously been handling data for as long as they've been publishing. I don't think we do it very well. I think we all recognize like the supporting material, which started, most publishers started actually before the web on microfiche, which was a bad way of doing it, but it was how we could do it, to supplemental material, which is mostly PDF or, you know, there's no metadata, there's often limited peer review of that. So one reason I think that, and I would say that Nature Scientific Data is kind of leading in this, is working specifically with repositories is for that reason. Kirsten will talk about how we're trying to help in the Earth and Space Sciences, how to help journals and repository authors identify the best repositories. And that's part of what the Coalition on Publishing Data in the Earth Science, in the Earth and Space Sciences, part of what we formed that for was exactly that, which is helping researchers identify the repositories and by journals endorsing them help elevate best practices. But I think, you know, and essentially that's what Scientific Data has been doing, is saying these are the repositories that we work with because they have these attributes. I think that's the reason that publishers are trying to move away from or recognizing that the way we've been handling supplemental information is in some cases providing the data, but is not providing the necessary best discoverability use support of that. It's been a default that publishers have had. And I think, you know, the extreme example was the Journal of Neuroscience, which banned all supplemental data. I think that was a mistake because I think those they ended up losing more data than they preserved. But it's a problem that we've recognized. Erica, do you want to?
I mean, I can't speak to all the criteria that are used to select the repositories that are recommended. I can tell you the one primary factor is availability for reuse of the data. So for example, repositories that are linked to institutions sometimes are not preferred because the reuse of the data is limited to the people affiliated with the institution. So that's one major criteria, but there's a lot of work that goes into selecting the repositories that are recommended.
Well, thank you very much, and a round of applause to all speakers.